Welcome, everyone. This is Lecture 4 in the Mises Academy class, Adventures in Energy Economics. So today's lecture is going to be the Economics of Climate Change Part 2, where I'm going to be walking through several problems with the conventional case for government intervention, in specifically in energy markets because of the alleged threat of climate change. So Lecture 3, I gave the standard mainstream view, and now in Lecture 4, I'm sort of from an Austrian free market perspective going to explain some of the problems with that standard case for why government allegedly should come in and use various measures to restrict carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions. Okay, so here's the outline of what we're doing. Notice the first thing I'm going to do is quickly review carbon taxes versus cap and trade, because I kind of rushed through that at the end of last lecture, and I do want to just make sure you guys understood that particular point. So first of all, again, let me just make sure you understand the terminology. So a carbon tax is, just like the name suggests, where the government levies an official tax on carbon dioxide emissions, and so the emitter has to pay that amount to the government. Whereas a cap and trade scheme, what the government's doing is determining how many units of emissions are going to be legally allowed, and then it issues those number of permits, either by auctioning them off or just giving them to people. And then the way you comply with that law is, if you're going to, you know, the government's going to figure out in practice where it's going to levy this thing. Like, it's not going to crack down individual people driving their car necessarily. It might just instead focus on refiners and say, okay, because people are going to use your gasoline, we know there's going to be so many emissions, so we're going to catch you right here. And they might, you know, go to power plants, things like that. But in the grand scheme of things, what they're doing is saying, we catch you, the way we regulate it is, if you're doing something that's going to lead to a ton of emissions, you have to show us that you've got one of these permits to give you permission to do that. And so then there's a market for these permits, and there's going to arrive a market price. And so, again, the two approaches, on the one hand, the carbon tax, the government setting the price, and then the market figures out what the level of emissions are based on that price. Everybody adjusts in light of the new fact that, now there's a tax being levied on what was previously free. Whereas with cap and trade, it's the other way around. The government's picking the quantity of emissions, and then the market's determining the price in response to that cap. And there's all kinds of, in practice, things that make these comparable to each other that, you know, like a cap and trade scheme in practice, they might say, well, there's a cap, but if the price ever goes above some critical threshold, then we'll issue unlimited permits at that price. So that, you know, like if it gets to be above $80 a ton, then the government's allowed to deviate from the schedule of permits that they had in the original legislation, and then people can go to the government and pay $80 a ton and get as many new permits, you know, at that price as they want. Okay, so they call those things like safety valves. So they have stuff like that in practice to try to make it so it's not as scary for people to go along with it. They don't want to, you know, if they set some cap thinking the price will probably be like $40 a ton, and then it ends up being $200 a ton, and businesses are complaining, you know, they don't want that. So that's, and like I say, in practice, there's like hybrid proposals. Same thing with the carbon tax. They might have say, oh, it's going to be $20 a ton, and it's going to rise at 2% a year. But if it turns out that emissions aren't falling on this course that we want, then we're going to increase the carbon tax, you know, to rise at 4% a year, or, you know, something like that. So that, like I said, the two in practice can be similar. But in their pure form, what's the difference? If you had perfect information, there wouldn't be a difference. That you could, whatever you want to be, whatever you thought the optimal carbon tax should be, which would be, oh, it should be $28 a ton, well, you could achieve the same result, because you'd say, okay, with that optimal carbon tax of $28 a ton, how would businesses respond and households respond to that? And you figure that out, and it's okay, so what would be the total amount of emissions in the presence of that $28 a ton carbon tax? It'd be some number, X number of tons of emissions. So then you could achieve that exact same outcome by doing cap and trade. And just saying, okay, we're going to have that magic number of emissions now being legally permissible. People would trade those permits in the market, and it would turn out that the market clearing price for that would be $28 for a permit that allows you to emit one ton. So that's the sense in which they would be, you know, kind of the same thing at a theoretical level where the government has all the information, but in practice they won't have that. And so this isn't an Austrian point. Let me make sure I get this isn't standard stuff that I'm giving you right now in the literature. I'm going over this again just because I think it helps clarify what a carbon tax is versus cap and trade. And also to see this kind of argument fleshed out gives you a sense of if you were to take a mainstream course in this, the kind of stuff you'd be learning. Okay, so these mainstream economists, when you ask them, so what's better, a carbon tax or cap and trade? Most of them are going to say a carbon tax, and then there's different reasons for it, but one of the main ones is what I'm now going to go over with you, that when there's uncertainty, depending on the different ways that the steepness of the marginal benefit, marginal cost curves interact with each other, either a carbon tax or a cap and trade would be better. And given what we think we know about what these curves look like in the real world when it comes to the issue of climate change, it means a carbon tax is better. Okay, so specifically, if you think that the marginal costs of dealing with further and further emission reductions is a steeper curve than the diminishing of marginal benefits from further and further emission reductions, then you want to go with a carbon tax, because if you're not sure of where the optimal intervention point is, making a mistake on the price side is less costly. Okay, so let me just, again, this is a review, but it's, I want to walk you through how these mainstream guys think about that. So this, the x-axis here is emissions reductions, and this, the y-axis is dollar amount. So when it comes to emission reduction, so going to the right on this thing means we have more reductions, so emissions are being restricted further and further. The you're going to have marginal benefits, and we're going to make that very gentle. The marginal cost, and we'll make that really steep. Make that really steep. So this P star and Q star are the optimal price of emissions. So like if you were going to set a carbon tax, that P star is the optimal carbon tax price. And the Q star, if you were going to, that's the optimal amount of emissions. So to figure out if you're going to issue permits, what the correct number of permits would be, it would be the current level of emissions, you know, the unregulated level of emissions minus that Q star, because you're going to allow. Mm-hmm. And so if you're not allowing it, that's got to be a reduction. Okay. So, again, if you knew what P star and Q star were, then carbon tax and cap and trade would be equivalent. But what if you were uncertain? So let's say, what if you accidentally, you know, doing a carbon tax, instead of doing it at P star, you did it a little bit higher up here. So let's say P and an H to mean it's too high. Well, then what happens is, we come over here, and so businesses restrict emissions in line with the marginal cost of emissions reductions. Now let me just walk you through the logic. What does that mean? What is this slope? The slope, steeply sloping MC curve. Because the idea is, why is it upward sloping? That the idea is to just tell industry, hey, cut back on 1 ton of carbon dioxide emissions. They could comply with that, and it wouldn't be a big deal because there's all kinds of substitutions and things they can do. They can use a little bit less electricity, or even if they, you know, use, they might use the same amount of electricity, but they can use electricity that's produced by natural gas and not by coal-fired power plant, right? So there's all kinds of ways. If you're just talking about 1 or 2 tons of emissions reduction, you can do it. It's not going to cost that much in terms of forfeited output. But then if you come along and say, hey, cut your emissions by 50% this year, well, that's going to have a huge impact, right? So if you look at the quantity of goods and services that could be produced now with this additional constraint saying CO2 emissions have to be 1/2 what they were last year, you know, go, now go do whatever you want, go ahead and maximize profit, do whatever you want, but with this additional constraint, now you can see why that would be very costly, right? Because now they don't have as many options because they're laying this new constraint on them. So that the idea is when you further restrict emissions, the marginal cost of complying with that is higher, and so we're saying if the steepness of this curve is shown, well, what if it increases pretty rapidly? So with that carbon, with the carbon price, what businesses will do is they'll say, okay, do we want to keep emitting and pay the government this dollars per ton in the carbon tax, or do we want to change what we're doing to cut back on emissions and then not have to pay the tax on that unit of emissions? So whatever the price, carbon price is, they will cut back until, you know, that thing hits the marginal cost curve. That's the idea. Okay, so then given that they're doing that, if they restrict until the point at which on the margin restricting an additional unit would be costlier to them than just paying the carbon tax, that means they're here. Okay, and so don't get confused. This is, so I'm calling this QH. So that means the emissions are high, reductions are higher than they should be. Okay, and so this is, again, partly why I'm going over this. I want to show you the mainstream guys on this. They're not completely insane. Okay, I mean, they don't say, oh, emissions need to go to zero for Mother Earth. That's not the way the mainstream economics of climate change literature works. They have cost-benefit analysis, and they have, you know, the optimal amount of emissions reductions in our mind, so it's not zero. So this QH is beyond Q star, meaning that carbon tax price is too high in this model with these cost curves. And so the government is overshooting and forcing businesses to restrict too much. So what's the impact of that in terms of mainstream analysis? Well, it's this triangle right here. Because what this is showing is it's for those units, it's the Q star to QH this way. On those units, those tons of carbon dioxide emissions that were not emitted now, and what's special about those, it's where the marginal cost is higher than the marginal benefit. And that's what's filling in that triangle there. And so what is this marginal benefit? What is this curve? Well, in this context, the marginal benefit of not emitting a ton of CO2 is the climate change damage from that emission that you're not now getting. Okay, so as you cut back on emissions more and more, you're sparing humanity a greater and greater amount of future climate change damages. But that's diminishing, right? The marginal benefit is dropping. Because, you know, with each further ton that you cut back, now your the damage that you're sparing, the increment is shrinking. If that makes sense. Okay, sorry, this is not my phone. So I'm not that right. Okay, so no, I'm just gonna I'll wrap this up soon. I won't go to the next slide of this. I'll just make it for the like real world case. So you get what I'm doing here. If the government made a mistake and set the carbon tax too high in the mainstream analysis, there would be a deadweight loss, the triangle that I just filled in. So now, what if, instead of that, what if they did a cap and trade, but they set the cap too low, meaning they crunch down on emissions and tighten the screws too quickly. So here, notice what I did, how much I made the P H higher than the P star. What if I did the same gap over here? So that would be like around here. If they were off by that much, you'd go up. And so the effective price would be way up there. And you can see that the triangle would be bigger. Okay, so all this is really saying is, if the curves look like this, and this is a general result, whenever you talk about government regulations using mainstream analysis, if the marginal cost curve is a lot steeper than the marginal benefit curve, then you want to have a price mechanism rather than any quantity mechanism. That's the general result. Not even talking about climate change, just in general, public finance, mainstream economics, that's the result. Now we're going to say applying that to the climate change debate, a price mechanism, i.e. a carbon tax, is probably better than a cap and trade. Okay, so that's the standard mainstream case. Here, I'm not going to walk you through it, but just so you know what the curve would look like. Suppose it were the other way around, you know, something like this. What if the marginal benefit curve were pretty steep and the marginal cost curve were more gradual like that, then it might be the other way around. Okay, and then if I even exaggerate it more, it'll clearly be the other way around, where getting the quantity a little bit off wouldn't be that big a deal, wouldn't create that big of a triangle, but getting the price off would totally mess you up. Okay, so again, that was just a review from last week. I wanted to make sure you got that. And again, the important point there is not so much why am I stressing that with you guys. It's not so much that I want you to know why the cap and trade is, or so why the carbon tax is preferred to a cap and trade, but it was more just to walk through the analysis and how mainstream economists think about these things. Because again, it's, don't confuse them with sort of capitalist-hating environmentalists who really don't want people to drive cars anymore. You know, somebody like William Nordhaus, that's actually not his perspective. William Nordhaus is one of the biggest proponents of a carbon tax. He's a pioneer in that literature. But in his work, he's pretty reasonable about saying things like, you know, we only want to have the optimal amount of emission reductions. If we overshoot, then we're hurting the economy too much compared to the gain we're getting from sparing environmental damage. Whereas a lot of people who are more ideological about it, certainly are not economists, I mean, to talk like that and say how much environmental destruction should we be willing to tolerate for the sake of economic growth, they would be like, oh, zero. What are you talking about? The optimal amount of climate change damage is zero. But that's not how a lot of mainstream economists talk about it. So, okay. So now, what would I say, just as if I had to summarize the remaining time we have here, some of the main problems with this standard case for government intervention. And it's important to stress this stuff because even a lot of, by normal metrics, free market economists, in my estimation, have a soft spot or a weak spot when it comes to the climate change debate. That lots of people that are in the public's eye would be considered libertarian, right-wing, free market economists, and yet they're all for even a large carbon tax. And so I'm largely framing the rest of tonight's remarks with those people in mind. Okay, so just this slide, I'm just going to be talking about in general problems with government intervention. So I mean, anytime somebody points to some problem in the world, you know, gang violence, unwed teenage pregnancy, school lunches, whatever the issue is, foreign wars, terrorism, and then they say, let's have the government come in and do X, Y, Z to make this situation better. I mean, there's a standard toolbox of things that a libertarian Rothbardian would say as to why that's not going to work. You know, that no, actually, just because you've identified this particular problem, it doesn't follow that therefore the government ought to come in and do X, Y, and Z more to make it better. So I'm not going to dwell too much on these because I think you guys know the argument. I want to give you more stuff tailored specifically to the climate change debate, but I didn't want to just ignore that these are huge, important points. So, for example, the knowledge problem, or what's people who stress this sometimes stress from a necessity perspective called the calculation problem, is that all of these things, you know, if you say, oh, there's this issue out there, the government can make it better, well, that assumes that the people in the government have the relevant information and that they know, you know, so more of a fundamental point, that they know the different valuations and can say what the proper trade-offs are. And that's problematic. That doesn't follow. The government, of course, doesn't have that information at its fingertips. Another, I mean, so you see that a little bit in the previous slide when I was talking about, you know, what if you didn't, you know, if you knew those marginal benefit, marginal cost curve, it seemed pretty nice to just, you know, draw them and have the intersection point, and that's a P star. And wow, who wouldn't want P star? There's a star after it, right? You know, so the way mainstream economists talk about this stuff, it's, you know, the amount of hubris they have is amazing. And well, later on, I'll save some of the specifics for a few slides from now. So I'll be more specific about what I mean in the climate change debate about the sort of knowledge that these people think they have and that they need to have for their case for work. Okay, another thing is just incentives that, okay, even if you did stipulate for the sake of argument that the people in the run of the government had the correct, you know, knowledge from experts and so forth on the ground feedback, and they understood economically the valuation and whether it made sense to forfeit one thing versus another. And what I mean there is just, suppose they did know perfectly well exactly the trade-offs involved. Oh, if we have another ton of CO2 emissions, then that's going to mean people in Bangladesh in 2087 are going to suffer these impacts and blah, 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 blah. And so what we can do is set up spare, you know, let's not emit that ton of CO2. And then what are the impacts going to be? Well, that means we're going to have higher gasoline prices and higher electricity prices. So even if you stipulated that they had that full spectrum of information and they knew the exact consequences, still, when you boil it down, you say, so should they do that or not? And how would they know? There would be no feedback mechanism analogous to the profit and loss system in a market economy by which they would know if they made the right decision. And so, you know, that's just like the calculation problem that Mises identified, and now I'm sort of pointing out that that works here as well, or is applicable here as well. Okay, but something even beyond that, or as a completely separate thing, is incentives, that even if you ignore the calculation and the knowledge problems, just the incentives of the people there that, you know, I mean, my sort of joke on this is to say, if they did get a carbon tax in place, I can promise you this, they're not going to consult with William Nordhaus every fiscal year and ask him, okay, well, now what's the optimal carbon tax rate? And they're going to just, you know, ramp it up according to what the disinterested scientists tell them is the socially optimal number. No, it's going to be political, and they're going to use it as a way to raise revenue. And next week's lecture, I'll give you guys some real world specifics of that. What will be seen as kind of legislation in places, and then to see what the politicians end up doing with this money. It was originally justified as, you know, part of some revenue neutral plan or something like that. Okay, so that's, you know, it's an issue also. And then finally, I'm just sort of cheekily saying from the folks who brought you Gitmo, is that it's this weird thing where people who are incredibly critical of the United States government when it comes to foreign policy and civil liberties, so I'm talking about like typical people on what's called the left wing in U.S. politics, are also typically some of the biggest advocates of government intervention in energy markets in the name of fighting climate change. And so it's weird that these people who, you know, on Tuesday are just, you know, the forces of demons in terms of locking innocent people up and torturing them, these are the most reprehensible people, on Wednesday, all of a sudden, that same group of people are going to be our, you know, are the guys that go to bat for us to stand up to these oil companies, and we can trust them to not do something that's going to, you know, harm poor people when their electricity bills go up. No, don't worry, the government will refund some of the carbon tax revenue to make sure that it deals with the impacts on poorer households, because we all admit that, yes, these proposals will make natural gas and electricity prices go up. You know, so, oh yeah, we can trust it. So it's, that's what I'm saying, that it's this odd thing where they alternate between being incredibly skeptical of the government, and yet they go to the government and say, hey, let's give them power over healthcare, or give them power over the energy sector. And, you know, their answer to everything is, well, that's why we got to just educate the public and elect somebody better next time. So it's pretty amazing that, so I guess what I'm saying is, to make it more specific, I'm not going to name any particular things, but there are large companies that I think a lot of people on the left believe are against climate change legislation, when actually, no, some of those companies are funding it. And I don't just mean companies that, like, produce wind turbines, which is obvious. I'm talking, like, oil companies that have made investments in natural gas, and, you know, because they had made projections internally thinking that, oh, we bet you at some point the U.S. government's going to have some kind of carbon pricing scheme in place. And so, you know, looking ahead in that kind of environment, they decided we want to get into, you know, our investments and get into natural gas more, because for a modest, like a carbon tax of, you know, anywhere from $1 to $30 a ton for the next few decades, that's going to cripple coal, but it won't knock out natural gas. In fact, natural gas will benefit, because you can't right now with the technology and the infrastructure. The U.S. couldn't just switch over to having most of its electricity produced by wind and solar and things like that. That just can't happen. At least not with a modest carbon tax, right? What would happen is the coal-fired plants would be put out of business, and the natural gas-fired power plants would expand. And that would, you know, end up producing a huge percentage of electricity. So my point is, a lot of, you know, there are certain very powerful energy companies that have made specific investments predicting that that was going to be the environment over the next few decades. And so I don't have, you know, I don't know, I can't prove this, but it wouldn't surprise me if they're the ones who are partly funding the move for a carbon tax now, because that's going to make their investments pan out. Whereas if it turns out not to be a carbon tax, they might say in retrospect, oh, we shouldn't have gotten somewhat heavily to natural gas. So, see what I'm saying? So part of it, and it was all the stuff, and yeah, I'll talk about this more next week when we get more into the real world politics of it, but it's just funny to see some of these real idealistic environmental crusaders pushing for the government to do this kind of thing, to stick it to the big businesses, when you see full well that the actual legislation that's being crafted, you know, has all kinds of handouts and things and favors to certain businesses that will benefit from it. That it's not this, you know, idealistic thing to crack down on business in the name of saving the environment. Okay, so now let me turn and go through some more specific problems with the standard case for government intervention because of climate change. And again, here, who's my audience that I have in mind for this? I'm thinking more of generally free market people who think, well, yeah, but, you know, I kind of believe in the concept of externalities. Maybe in a lot of cases they're overblown, they're not a big deal, but geez, you know, it seems like the scientists really do have a consensus on this climate change stuff, and why couldn't you they levy a carbon tax and then maybe use the money to reduce income taxes. That seems like a pretty good thing to do, right? That you're, you know, the phrase they use for that. Where is it? Is they'll say tax bad, not goods. All right, so that's a very catchy slogan they'll use. Say, hey, tax bad, not good. And by that word good, they don't mean like goods and services. They mean good things. So they're saying tax bad things, don't tax good things. So what they mean in this particular context with that is to say, hey, let's put in a carbon tax, and then if we use 100% of those revenues to reduce taxes on wages, well, then isn't that good? Because then that means, you know, yeah, maybe we want the government to not tax at all, but given that the government is taxing, surely you want it to be punishing or penalizing activities that we don't want to encourage. And so, yeah, we can disagree, and I'm not a scientist, I don't know, but clearly it looks like there's some problem with pumping more CO2 into the atmosphere. That's what the scientists apparently are telling us. And so why don't we have the government penalize that by applying taxes to that rather than having the government say to someone, hey, if you go earn income, we're going to tax you. But that seems crazy, right? So that's the logic. And like I say, a lot of otherwise free market libertarian type economists find that very compelling. That's why a bunch of them are for what they call a revenue neutral carbon tax. So I will, again, that's the kind of person I have in mind the rest of this lecture. Okay, so let's walk through some of the problems here. So one thing that everyone wants to bring up, and I won't skirt the issue, is the climate models themselves. Okay, that these computer models that are showing the relationship between carbon dioxide emissions and the physical climate, right? So these models that don't have anything to do with economics, this is just like a pure natural scientist having models that involve physics and chemistry and biology. You know, you have to worry about the algae and stuff in the oceans because they CO2 goes in and out through that mechanism as well. All right, so as you guys, I'm sure, are well aware, there's a whole spectrum of opinion on this, ranging from, oh yeah, this is all a complete hoax, the stuff in East Anglia proved it, there's this crazy, Al Gore just made it all up, to, you know, on the other end, that no, this is well established, and only some nut job who's being paid by an oil company or just isn't familiar with the actual public literature could possibly deny it. Right? So there's that range of opinions I'm sure you've heard. So my take on that, for what it's worth, first of all, I always give the disclaimer, obviously I'm not a trained climate scientist, so, but I did study the IPCC reports fairly in depth, you know, a few years ago when I was really immersed in this literature. And I don't, put it this way, I think a lot of the scientists who are in this field are sincere, all right? So I don't think they're all behind closed doors, you know, we're doing this for funding from the UN, or that it's part of their Marxist plot to allow governments to take over the world. I don't think in their mind they're consciously lying, all right? And yeah, I know there is those climate emails. Some of the stuff those guys were doing was definitely shady. And so, you know, those people, you know, what did they think they were doing something that was wrong in normal context, what was justified? Maybe so. But I'm saying the rank and file scientists in this literature, I don't think is consciously altering data or anything like that. But the problem is these models are so open-ended and you can tweak things, and they're actually not reproducible experiments yet. Mostly what they do is backfit, right? So when they say, you know, when you read these IPCC reports to say, why are they so confident that man-made emissions are the things responsible for a large degree of the observed warming, they'll say things like, well, because when we try to reconstruct the temperature patterns that we observed, that we get the best fit when we assume that man's influence is such and such. And it, you know, we can't fit the observations as well if we try to attribute it to solar activity or blah, blah, blah. Right? So that's the thing. So, but as you may know, just in general, that's a very dangerous way to proceed, is just to look at the data you've already got and then try to come up with an explanation that way that involves a lot of moving parts. Really what people are interested in is say, okay, take your model now and apply it to new data going forward. You make predictions and according to the way your models calibrate, and then go look at new stuff. So not, you know, don't tinker with your model and your parameters after you already seen the results. You know, make projections going forward and not how all of those pan out. So there's lots of different ways. I mean, if you go read people who believe in these models, they'll tell you, yeah, they're fine. And if you go read other people who don't like them, they'll say, no, they're totally wrong. The most even-handed summary I've seen is contained in this chart that I'm showing you right now. Let me just briefly explain what it is. So this thing down here is the trend line. So this is not it's not like showing you the passage of time per se. It's showing you what happens as the trend gets longer. So it's not like an additional year. It's not like there's a base year here and then we're just advancing it by year. That's not what this is. It's showing you looking at the models and the projections they made in a given year. And then if you went forward from the time that projection was made. Okay. And so the big thing in all this is that there's uncertainty. So the and that's the way the standard modelers try to exonerate their products, because as you guys know, I'm sure there has been, depending on how you measure it and so forth, global temperatures have been relatively flat for at least like the last 10 years. All right. And so even in spite of the fact that CO2 concentrations have been continually rising, at least before then at a fairly rapid rate. So the idea is, so how do they get around that? They say, well, there's uncertainty. There's volatility in these things. There's all kinds of short-term factors, you know, El Nino, you know, solar activity, blah, 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 that could throw the measurement one way or the other in a given year, but you know, the long-term trend is still clear that human activity is leading to rising global temperatures and we need to act now. So in the models themselves, they try to quantify the uncertainty and they give confidence intervals to say this is what, you know, the global temperature will be next year, next year, next year. So the point is, if you go far enough into the future, that confidence interval, it should shrink, because a lot of these things that are uncertain in any given year, well, you kind of know how it's going to play out over the next 30 years, if that makes sense. So that's why in this chart, what this yellow band is showing, these are the upper and lower ranges to keep that whole estimate within 90% confidence interval. And so, like I say, that it shrinks over time because the trend line is getting longer. So the variables are uncertain in the models. That, you know, they kind of know where they're going to be or how it's going to play out over 30 years, but they will cancel out and that kind of thing. So what you can see is the green is the average estimate, and it makes sense to smack that in the middle of that yellow range. And then this down here is the actual observations. It's, you know, these different observations from, you know, because that's the thing too. When you really get into this stuff, you say, what's the global temperature? What that even mean? You know, there's, you're talking about at the ground level, you're talking about, the lower atmosphere, what measuring stations are you talking about? taking an observation every day and averaging over the year. So even just that term to speak of the global temperature, that's actually kind of a subtle concept that you have to define in practice. Okay, so that's why these observations are different slightly, but you can see they're all fairly close. And it makes a difference if you measure using satellites or if you use thermometers that are based on the ground, that kind of thing. Okay, so you can see that there's two things about this chart. One is that actual temperatures are consistently below the green, so there has been less actual warming than the models predicted. But beyond that, also, you see how over time this yellow thing is coming up with and flirting with the observations. So what that means is if this trend were to continue, where the yellow keeps getting squished closer and closer and those observed temperatures don't rise, then and incidentally, this is not a measure of the absolute level of temperature. This is the trend, so degrees Celsius per decade. So this line here is consistent with warming. It's just less warming than the models predicted. So the point is, what would it mean if that yellow continued to shrink such that that other line broke through? It would mean, okay, the observed temperatures are now lower than the models themselves said should happen, not what, I guess 95% of the time. Should not happen 95% of the time because it's the lower 5% confidence interval, you know what I'm saying? Right, so again, it doesn't mean that the models have been falsified because they had uncertainties in them. It just means they're saying if this model is accurately capturing the real climate system and how it operates, we would not expect to see this, or we would only see this kind of outcome 5% of the time, where the actual warming was this weak relative to what we think should have been, you know, normally happened. All right, so that's so the way Chip Knappenberger characterized this, he said the model is on the verge of failing. Okay, let me show you this. This is, again, sort of inside baseball stuff, but I'm assuming some of you are taking this course because you're familiar with the standard arguments and kind of like get your hands dirty. This is from the, well, I tell you right here where it's from if you want to go source it and read more about it. This is not, the point of this chart is I just want to show you, I'm going to say the purpose of this, right? Purpose is just to show how unlikely extreme scenarios are, even according to the models contained in the IPCC reports. Okay, because what you're going to find is a lot of the really scary projections about, you know, hey, here's how it goes. When you're running these models to try to come up with the impacts of CO2 emissions, even on their own terms, even if we stipulate the stuff that's in the IPCC report, the numbers just aren't that big. And especially, like, I'll reiterate the point in a minute, you know, make sure you guys get that one. If you use a market discount rate, there's nothing. Because what's driving it is because the damages don't even kick in until 2075 or beyond, depending on the parameters. And so it's just nothing. So there's using standard cost-benefit analysis, they cannot justify government, you know, extreme government action. It's like so low, it's not even worth doing anything. And so they don't like that. And so they got to come up with, well, and they say stuff like, well, we can't just use standard cost-benefit analysis looking at, you know, the average outcomes because these models do show in certain extreme scenarios really awful things could happen. And there could be like a chain runaway effect, you know, where if it warms to a certain degree, then all of a sudden the polar ice caps melt, and then, you know, then there's more warming and so forth. Right. So that's the idea is that there could be these things that could are really awful, like to knock out a quarter of world GDP once warming gets to be like a 10 degrees Celsius. All right. But that's the thing, is all of these really horrible outcomes involve temperature increases. Again, these are always calibrated relative to like 1750 of, you know, 6, 7 degrees, 8 degrees, 9 degrees Celsius. And so what I'm saying is, when people talk about it, you can just look at the IPCC's own models and say, well, how likely are those outcomes? And you can see that what this is showing, it's technically called a probability density function. It just is meaning like the amount of area under these curves is showing like how much of the probability is concentrated in that region. All right, and so the x-axis on all these charts is the warming in degrees Celsius, and the y is showing the probability mass that's centered there. So these various B1s and A1Bs and all that stuff, those are just different emission scenarios. Okay, and then these things are showing you the color coding is showing you the different kinds of models that they're talking about. The models are different. So the point is, you can just see, you can see here, like with B1, so that, I don't know off the top of my head, but that must be, and also they're showing you the year, you know, the time interval. So they're saying the B1 emission scenario between the years 2020 and 2029, what kind of warming do we expect to see? And you can see it's all concentrated right in this area. And after that, I mean, it's just so unlikely that you're going to see more than that much warming by 2029. But if you do the B1 emission scenario, you know, how much warming will there be in this last decade of this century? You can see it's shifted up. But still, it's only like this one model, this model, this red line model. So this guy, this nudie guy in 2003, his model is the only one that even showed remote chance of there being 4 degrees warming or 4.2 by that. So I'm just walking through and trying to get you to see how you read these charts. So anyway, the point is that what regardless of the emission scenario, and even looking out through the year 2100, there's only one model that's even showing you the slightest little bit of probability of these extreme things, and they don't even go up. Look at the highest they go up is 8 degrees Celsius, and a lot of these government reports and things, they'll justify and say, well, we're going to focus on really catastrophic outcomes that would occur, you know, like at 9 degrees Celsius, 10 degrees Celsius. And I'm just saying it's kind of funny that the IPCC didn't even bother extending the axis that far out when they're plotting the probabilities on these things, because it's just so unlikely. And yet that is what is being used to justify all these interventions. So it's sort of like with a lot of this stuff, and the testimony I gave to the Senate, oh, by the way, that I think they sent out an email blast, Ryan did, but my testimony to the Senate last week, the YouTube of that, you guys have it now, the link to that. And I think a lot of people watching that are going to be able, some of it I'm referring to government, you know, issued guidelines issued by the Office of Management and Budget. And they, you know, the Obama administration's working group did not follow those guidelines when spitting out these numbers for the social cost of carbon. And I think a lot of people are like, well, Bob, what are you saying? That the OMB is now the authority on this? And it's kind of like when Tom Woods did the talk on who killed the Constitution. And he always, you know, if he's talking to a crowd of Rothbardians, he kind of has to defend himself. But look at, regardless of whether you like the Constitution or not, the point is the government had these rules that it says it's going to follow. And it's just hilarious when it doesn't follow the rules to see, you know, the explanations it gives. Same thing here. It's just funny to me that they're, you know, I don't have to throw out the IPCC report. I could critique everything they're doing just looking at the report. And the same thing with my Senate testimony. A lot of the Senate, I'll talk more about this next, but a lot of the senators there were all blustering and assuming I was a denier and all that kind of stuff. All I was doing was reading them within the government's own report. You know, I just flipped past page one of the executive summary. I went to the guts of it. Everything I was saying came right from the report. But yet it was so contrary to the narrative that they were assuming that I was making stuff up. So, all right, let's move on here. Okay, let me talk about limited adaptability. So again, yeah, I see in the quotes or the comments people were concerned about the PDF. Yeah, in that previous chart, PDF stood for probability density function. And, you know, if you don't know what that means, just loosely speaking, it just is showing you, like, how likely is something going to happen. The steeper that thing is, strictly speaking, you would, you know, the probability of it falling in between two things on that x-axis, you would look at the area under the curve between those two points. Okay. Limited adaptability. So, again, make sure you're not getting lost here. I am going through very specific problems with the case for government intervention in the name of fighting climate change. And so let me just explain some of the things that's going on here. So early on, so early damage estimates were huge. Because they cherry picked. And let me give you an example. So first of all, this might surprise you. The estimates, and you'll see this, again, it'll be optional, but when the video of IER's carbon tax conference, which was also last week, when that's made available, I'll send you guys those things. And this is part of what I talk about. You probably had this impression that, oh my gosh, the scientific results keep coming in and the situation's even worse than we realize. And we really need to take it, and no, it's the opposite. The estimates now of what the social costs of carbon are lower than they were a few years ago. And I'm talking about in the peer reviewed literature. I'm not talking about the government's reports made it 50% higher. The government, the report that just came out in May, their estimates are 50% higher than they were from the, you know, analogous government report that came out in 2010. But I'm saying in the peer-reviewed literature, the estimates of the social cost of carbon are generally falling. And part of why what's driving that is they're building in more realistic adaptation abilities for the people in these models. And so just let me give you an example of the kind of thing I mean. So originally, they would do stuff like, assume that farmers don't rotate crops. Okay, so I'm saying the original damage functions, you know, way back when this field was in its infancy, and they would come up with these big impacts of, oh my gosh, look at what's gonna happen. If there's such and such amount of warming, this is gonna hurt agriculture by X billion dollars. And what they were doing in those models is they were assuming that as the temperature changed and the rainfall changed and all that type of stuff, that farmers just stupidly kept planting the same crops. And so then, you know, researchers came along a few years later and said, well, what if we allow the farmers in these models to plant crops that were more suitable for the climate as it changed? And that, you know, at any given point, they planted a crop that made the most sense. And then all of a sudden, you know, lo and behold, the impacts were a lot less severe. Another example is they would, this was, I'll just follow the right scheme and just talk you through it. So some of those early things that were showing large impacts, they would say stuff like, oh, well, if you, countries that have a lot of tourism, involving like snow skiing, you know, resorts where you're skiing down the mountain with snow on. With global warming, that's going to be hurt because now the winter is going to be shorter and it's not going to snow as much and all that kind of stuff. And so they were including the monetary value of those damages from the lost tourism. And then again, other researchers came a lot later and said, well, okay, but then the people who have tourism for water skiing in the winter, in the summer, are now going to have a longer season because the summer will be longer, and you know, and more people will want to go out in the water and stuff if it's warmer, and so we should include the benefits of that. And then lo and behold, when you didn't just look at the bad things, when you looked at the offsetting good things, all of a sudden the impacts weren't as big. So that's, I mean, things like that where it's, I guess what I'm trying to say is if you set out to go quantify all of the horrible things that will happen when the globe gets warmer, you're going to be able to find them. And you're going to be able to add up all these numbers and come up with humongous numbers. Whereas if you want to go out and try to find things that are going to be good, you can also come up with huge numbers. Things like fewer people will die in the winter because of, you know, when it's really cold, a lot of elderly people die in the winter. And so that won't happen as much if the winter's not as cold. All right. There's more CO2. It reduces water stress on plants. And so, you know, they perform better, at least for a certain range. Okay. So there's all kinds of things like that that you can go find. And it's my point with these particular examples about the farmers not rotating crops. I mean, that's just so obvious in the skiing thing where how could you, you know, include one but not the other to just show that it looked like these earlier estimates were just cherry picking. Another thing about this limited adaptability that to me is just one of the most decisive. A lot of the, I can't give you the exact number because they didn't publish it. They didn't say those intermediate results. But a lot of the, like today's social cost of carbon, and so if they were going to levy a carbon tax today and put it at whatever, $20 a ton, possibly around half of that number being driven by damages in the computer models that don't start occurring until after the year 2100. All right, so let me just say that again in different words. When mainstream economists right now relying on these standard models in the literature are throwing out numbers for how much the economic impact is today of us emitting carbon and why the government should do certain policies today to get us to curb our emissions, depending on the model and depending on the discount rate, general ballpark, at least half of that number or whatever is occurring because of projections they're making that occur after the year 2100. And so to me, to be honest, I mean, a lot of the two is even, I got a percentage of things. They didn't save these results, these intermediate results, publish them. But I've seen the damage functions, and it wouldn't surprise me if even like a third of them don't occur until after the year 2200. And by the way, what's happening, I mean, is that they have things like showing if there's 10 degrees of warming, that 25% of global GDP is forfeited. And so they have that kind of thing in there in their model that could happen under certain scenarios in the year 2280. And so in the year 2280, there's a $50 trillion loss. And so then even discounting it by that many hundreds of years today, it's still kicking in, you know, $8 worth of damage. And so that is today's carbon tax. So just think about that for a minute. You're telling me in the year 2280 that because they have too much CO2 in the atmosphere, they're just going to sit there and suffer a 25% lower world output, and they're not going to have any way to deal with that. They're not going to be able to just suck CO2 out of the atmosphere in the year 2280, and that's crazy. They'll probably have populated the solar system at that point. And so it's sort of like imagine if people in the year 1700 were making decisions based on their understanding and projections of what our technology today would be like, and the kind of things we would be worried about today. Do you think they would know that in the year 1700? Just to give you a real-world example, in like the early 1900s, there are real funny like essays from people and proposals and all kinds of stuff about like city planners who are really worried that certain industrial centers, you know, certain cities that are growing too fast, and the government really needs to take in measures to limit the population growth of these major cities, because they were making projections and saying at this rate, you know, by year 19, whatever, 35 or something, we're just going to be just filled with horse manure. That we're not going to be able to, you know, the city's just going to be filling up with horse manure. We're not going to be able to get rid of it all because that was the way people moved around when these projections were being made. But horses would go through and then, you know, they would have to deal with the waste products that the horse produced. And so they just extrapolated and said, well, gee, this continues. What are we going to do? Not realizing, well, that no, pretty soon we're not going to use horses anymore. This kind of thing. So I think it's a very similar thing here where I imagine in the year 2200, if they stumble upon our debates today and see that people were seriously considering crippling industrial output today because of the, you know, their fear about what CO2 emissions would mean to people in 2200, you know, they would probably think that was funny. All right, let's move on. Okay, so I touched on this a little bit. Again, I talked about it last week, but let me just come back to it because it's a pretty important point. With these things, even if you stipulate the models and say, yeah, I'm not questioning the physical science models that the climate scientists are making. I'm not even questioning the models that guys like Nordhaus are making, because those are different, by the way. Let me make sure you guys get that. There's the climate models that just look at weather systems and things like that, model solar radiation and CO2 concentrations, and they have the oceans and the you know, being a heat sink and all this kind of stuff. So there's those things. Those are pretty complex. But then there's the what's called the integrated assessment models that involve the economy. So there, the climate system's not as complicated as there. And they just calibrate it based on the results of the more complicated climate computer simulations. Because it can't be as complicated, but they have to leave room for the economy. If that makes sense to you guys, right? So so I'm saying even if you stipulate those things and don't worry about all the stuff I just brought up about the damage functions being kind of arbitrary and relying on cherry picking and all that kind of stuff, I'm saying using their own results, just the discount rate you choose can drive everything. So again, this comes from the White House Working Group's own report that came out in May. And what, let me just make sure you understand how to, if you understand how to read this chart, you'll be smarter than most of the people in Washington. So this is color coded. So what they did, they had the result. They picked three models, three of the integrated assessment models. One was William Nordhaus's DICE model. One was this guy Richard Toll's fund model. The other one is the PAGE model. I think it's by a guy named Chris Hope, but I'm not sure about that. And they plugged in various scenarios of emissions growth. Because that's the thing, too. When you say how warm is the Earth going to be in the year 2100, that's not merely a question about understanding of physics and chemistry. You also have to make projections about, well, what do I think CO2 emissions are going to be like over the next 100 years? Because that's one of the key inputs. So that's, again, partly why these models are so open-ended. So anyway, they plugged in a bunch of different emissions trajectories that they got from other people's projections, and then they spit out these numbers of the social cost of carbon. But because, and they also put in uncertain, or I should say random estimates of the globe sensitivity to emissions. So, but they calibrated it based on the IPCC estimates. All right, so the point is these computer simulations don't just spit out a dollar figure and say, oh, the social cost of carbon is $32.15. Instead, because they were plugging in random things. What they did is they ran these simulations thousands of times, and then they would get the social cost of carbon. It, you know, could be $32.16 for one run, but then they don't report it as that. They keep track of that number, and then they run it thousands of times and keep track of each time what the number is, and then they're reporting this distribution. And so they're okay. So these are all the same runs. It's not like they, it's not like these color coding schemes refer to different types of inputs or something. The only thing is if they're looking at the numbers, the stream of estimates of possible upfront benefits and future damages in a given scenario, emission scenario, a given run choice of the climate sensitivity in that particular run of the model, then they'll give you the output, and then they'll discount its output at 2.5, 3, and 5%. And then you report the numbers, so they'll come up with three different numbers. So for each run, it's like they got three different numbers. And then they run it thousands of times, and then average them all together, but segregate the results by discount rate. And that's what this chart is showing. So you can see that the red one is flatter and it's, pulled more to the right. And then as you increase the discount rate, it gets scrunched and steeper in the middle. And then especially when you move it to blue, it gets scrunched even more. And again, the intuition, why is that happening? Because there's 30 years, give or take, of benefits. So the social cost of carbon is negative for those first 30 years or whatever. And then from that point through the year 2300, it's positive, meaning it's harmful. And so if you're, the higher the discount rate, the less weight you're attributing to those future harms, and the more weight you're putting on the benefits. And so you can just see, and so what's driving this, I think, is that there's a lot of really big numbers lurking in the years, 2200 to 2300, humongous damages. And so if you have a 3-5% discount rate, those just don't really weigh that much in our present calculation. Okay, so anyway, the point of me walking through this is to show you, if I want to challenge the government's own argument for why to do this, I don't even need to bring up the knowledge problem or something. I don't need to go to some outside, and I didn't go to Richard Lindzen of MIT and say, hey, this guy says that the climate models are bogus. I don't need to do any of that. I can just take the government's own numbers, because what they're doing, they're not showing you here, they should have. There should be another box with another color that should show it at 7%. Because the Office of Management and Budget says they're supposed to do that. So that's the estimate of the average return to capital. And so they're saying, well, if a government regulation is going to displace capital, the opportunity cost, you should quote it at 7%. So that's where that number comes from. And they say quite clearly, even in the context of climate change, they're saying, yeah, if it's something that affects future generations, you can go ahead and quote it at a lower number in addition to the standard 3% and 7%. But they didn't do the 7%, because what would happen is it would scrunch even more. Be like this over here. And we can't know for sure, but it's possible that it would actually be negative. But you see where, like, look at this 5%. They quoted the number at $12 because that's the average. So that's like where the 50% mark is, the median of this probability distribution. All right. So I'm saying if they did it at 7%, clearly, the whole thing would be shifted to the left even more, so there'd be more probability mass that was negative, more that was a very low number. And I'm saying it's possible that the median value would actually fall to the left of the $0 mark. And even if it didn't, it would still be a much lower, it'd be a lot lower than $12. So it's just one of those funny things where my guess is, when I and others are harping on this point, that the people in the administration, why didn't we, because it's kind of an obscure thing. I didn't even know about it. Somebody else brought to my attention saying, hey, the OMB said they're supposed to use a 7% discount rate, but not. I didn't know that until someone brought it up. So it's just kind of funny that they were just trying to ram this thing through. And everyone said, whoa, wait a minute. How come you're not following this rule? Yeah. Okay, a couple more. Let me see what other slides we got here. Okay, just pacing myself. Leakage. So this term comes from the literature. What it refers to is the fact that cracking down on emissions will boost emissions in other jurisdictions. Okay, so I apologize for that poor handwriting. It says cracking down on emissions will boost emissions in other jurisdictions. So here the idea is, even if I stipulated everything else and said, okay, yeah, the social cost of carbon is $20 a ton, meaning that if we looked at the world and they had X tons of carbon emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, and there'd be a certain amount of damage, and then if we had X minus 1 tons of carbon dioxide emissions, the damage would be that amount minus $20. Then, okay, by definition, the social cost of carbon $20. But it wouldn't follow from that, even if I stipulated everything else, it would not follow that therefore the U.S. government should put in place a carbon tax of $20 a ton. Because cracking down to reduce U.S. emissions by one ton is not the same thing as reducing global emissions by one ton. Because when you crack down on U.S. emissions, you're creating incentives for other people to increase their emissions. And so, again, that phenomenon studied in mainstream literature is called leakage. To see it more clearly, I mean, imagine if just one city, you know, some mayor decided, oh, I'm going to just completely ban carbon dioxide emissions because the scientists tell me that we really need to, you know, have a no tolerance policy. We got to really get this thing under control. So I'm the mayor. I'm going to say, boom. Starting next year, you know, we'll chop your head off if you emit any CO2. Ironically, chopping someone's head off would probably emit CO2, but you get the point. So they go ahead and do that. What's going to happen? Is there going to see a drastic decline in global emissions? No. All that's going to happen is the people who live in that town are all going to move. All the businesses that are there are just going to go out of business and relocate elsewhere. Okay, so you might see a small drop in global emissions. Or you might not, because maybe all the people moving are not going to drive more, and that's actually going to produce more. But you see the point that you can't just go from talking about what would happen if the world cut back one unit to then saying, therefore, you should set policy and try to achieve that domestically. So what ends up happening if you're doing a proper cost-benefit mainstream approach analysis, you would crack down on it less. So in other words, the optimal carbon tax is actually less than the social cost of carbon because of this issue of leakage. And the smaller the jurisdiction, the bigger that effect would be. So if just the state of California implements a straight-out carbon tax, well, then they should put it much lower relative to social cost of carbon, whereas if the U.S. as a whole did it, it would be closer to what the theoretical social cost of carbon was. So again, I'm not even challenging the Pigouvian framework. I'm saying even on its own terms, the way these people in the mainstream literature are using this stuff is not right. Okay, this tax interaction effect, let me spend just a little bit of time on it. This is kind of a subtle point, but it's also important. So this, the context of this has to do with a carbon tax swap. So the idea is, like I said, some conservatives are pushing this. They're saying, hey, let's take revenues from a carbon tax and use them to reduce corporate income taxes, the standard individual income taxes. And I don't even care if there's global warming or not. I don't care. All I'm saying is that will help the economy because we'll be, you know, clearly we want to reduce the disincentives on productive output. And if we increase tax on CO2 emissions, you know, hey, for all we know, maybe Al Gore's right. Right. And I've seen that kind of rhetoric. All right, that's not in the standard literature. The actual literature on this stuff is saying that's wrong. And so this table I took was from one of the pioneers in this field. And let me back up a second. The intuition for why is a carbon tax more economically damaging than a tax on income? One way to see it is to say that the base of a carbon tax is narrower. And so if you study this, tax analysis, to raise a given dollar amount of revenue, you want to have a broader base with lower marginal rates applied so that you're not changing behavior as well. All right. So, for example, if they just said, oh, we're going to have the same income tax revenues before, but we're only going to tax people with red hair. So what does the tax on labor have to be to bring in the same amount of revenue as before, but now we're only going to apply to people to work with red hair? Well, there'd be a lot more distortions now. You'd have to jack the rate way up, and so that, people with red hair might not work anymore, or they would just, do stuff under the table. So the economic impact, the dead weight loss, the way mainstream economists describe it, of a carbon tax, the best estimates think, is worse than of an income tax. And so it doesn't follow automatically, let's lower the carbon tax, and then use the revenue to lower the income tax, and we'll be better off. And hey, we might even get an environmental benefit to boot. That doesn't follow. Okay, so these people tried to quantify this looking at the U.S. tax code, and it was actually, you can see, so they're saying, let's assume that there are environmental damages. Like, this is what the social cost of carbon over here. Like, these are the negative pavilion externalities. And then they're saying, okay, so what would the optimal textbook Pavlovian tax be? If you're not even worried about the other taxes there, it would just be those numbers, right? That's what Pavu says, and that's what the people in this, just commenting on this thing. But then they say, okay, what if now you take account of interaction with other taxes? So what's happening here is the point is, you can't just look at it in a vacuum. You can't assume, which people normally do, that, hey, let's imagine if we had no taxes, it's totally free market, and then there's this negative externality. What should we do? Oh, put in place a Pavlovian tax calibrated to the amount of the damages, and then it will internalize the externality, and we'll have a new equilibrium. And so these people are coming along saying, wait a minute, though. In practice, there's already distortionary taxes there, and so you've got to worry about when you introduce this new carbon tax, how does it interact with the existing taxes that are screwed up anyway. And that's what the tax interaction effect is. So you can see, if they just distribute the carbon tax receipts lump sum, if the damages are $25 a ton, the optimal carbon tax is zero. Even if a ton of CO2 causes $50 a ton in environmental damages in terms of climate change damages, still the optimal carbon tax is zero, given the pre-existing U.S. tax code, because that's how you read this thing. Now, it's true, if you use the receipts to reduce other taxes, it's better than just giving it back lump sum. But still, look at for example, this $50 one. $50 a ton. So again, assuming for the sake of argument that the ton of CO2 causes $50 in present discounted value of climate change damages, even if you use 100% of the revenue to reduce income taxes, the optimal carbon tax would only be $27 a ton, according to this particular calibration and estimate. All right, so that is the exact opposite of what these pro-carbon tax people are saying. They think they're bolstering the case for a carbon tax by saying, the current U.S. tax code is really screwed up and inefficient, and so we can use these revenues. And it's the other way around, that the more screwed up the current income tax is, the less you would want to introduce a new carbon tax, even if 100% of its revenues were used to reduce the pre-existing screwed up tax code. So it's really counterintuitive. You'd think it'd be the other way around. You'd think the more screwed up the current tax code is, the better it would be to have some new tax than you would reduce it, but it's the other way around. Okay. I know I'm eating into your Q&A time, but let me just walk through this last slide here.
Oh, sorry. Are you okay with saving the files?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think so.
Okay. So you see you at the second?
Yeah. Cool. Okay. 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 So what if you The last point I want to make here, what if you overshoot? The cure could be worse than the disease. So again, I've already done more fundamental objections with this stuff, even on their own terms. So this is coming from the DICE model that William Nordhaus developed. And these figures are, I think, from his 2007 calibrations. So if you look at it more recently, these numbers will be different, but the spirit is the same. Okay, so let me just walk through this. What he did is he said, okay, if you guys set an optimal, you know, worldwide carbon tax, all the governments of the world set it perfectly based on what my model suggests is the social cost of carbon, there would be certain compliance costs, or what are called abatement costs, or, you know, complying with the thing that in conventional GDP would be lower, because now we have this extra constraint that we have to restrict our emissions, but we would spare ourselves future climate change damages of a certain amount. And so he's saying if we did it optimally, we could, you know, the benefits would outweigh the cost to the tune of $3.37 trillion as of the time when this estimate came out. Okay? So there would be, you know, a certain amount of gains that would be 3.37 trillion more than the cost of that we were imposing on households and businesses to comply with this thing. Okay. So okay, but what if instead of that we limited CO2 to 560 parts per million, which is a popular proposal. That 560 parts per million is double the pre-industrial level. That's where that number comes from. So a lot of people are saying, hey, let's limit it to a doubling of atmospheric CO2. Just to give you a frame of reference, right now it's about 400 parts per million. So if you did that, the benefits would be lower, but they would still be positive. And the reason for that, why are the benefits lower? Because this goal, this strategy, is kind of arbitrary. It's just, you know, to just pick a number out of the air and say, let's limit it to, you know, that's kind of weird, because you want to do it economically correct. You want things to be done in terms of marginal cost and marginal benefit. So that's why Nordhaus is an economist. You know, he's a mainstream economist, but still an economist. That's why he favors this. Because he's saying we should not be in the business of picking some atmospheric concentration. All we should do is figure out what is the negative externality and then put in place the appropriate correction from the government in terms of carbon tax, and then let the market do the rest. We should not be dictating anything beyond that. That would be top-down central planning. And the way that superiority manifests itself in his model is the fact that that number is bigger than that number. Okay. He said, okay, what if we did the Kyoto Protocol and included the U.S.? Well, benefits drop significantly, the net benefits, because, you know, the Kyoto didn't include some from a country. So he's saying if we only had a certain amount of countries in it doing this, then the other countries outside that agreement are going to continue to increase emissions, and so it's less effective. And you can see that all the more so, well, what if they did the Kyoto Protocol without U.S. participation, and so the U.S. emissions are just on a business-as-usual path? Well then, now we're getting close to, you know, that's just $150 billion. So now it's almost not worth even doing. And then look at some of these other things he showed. What if people, well, if we limited CO2 to 420 parts per million, as a lot of environmentalists are calling for? Because they're really worried about tipping points, things like that. The net benefit would be negative $14.87 trillion, meaning if they were to foolishly limit CO2 concentrations to 420 parts per million, that would spare a lot of potential future climate change damage, but it would impose tremendous costs to just a conventional economy to have to adapt to cutting down emissions that drastically, so that overall we don't surpass 420 parts per million in the atmosphere, such that the present value of the abatement costs would be roughly $15 trillion higher than the benefits. Okay, and then the worst one he said was Al Gore had done a proposal, and you know that was about a $22 trillion loss. So the reason I bring this up to mainstream economists who are for this stuff is, look, this is from William Morehouse. This isn't me thinking of numbers. This is his own report, his own assessment that, look at, the very best thing that is theoretically possible, all the governments of the world just said, yes, Professor Nordhaus, tell us what to do. We are your servant. And did that perfectly for the next 100 years. So that's the thing, too. It's not just keeping the carbon tax in place for a few years. It's keeping it in place at the optimal level, adjusting it in line with the new estimates and so forth, at least for the next century, in order to get this result. And that is swamped by the bad things that could happen if they screw it up. And again, these proposals aren't figments of Nordhaus's imagination. He went out to some of the actual policy proposals that people were demanding, including Al Gore, who people, you know, won the thing for, you know, bringing this to everyone's attention. So you can see how, so that's the point I'm making, is that that's not a good distribution. Where the very best thing that could happen, if this works and is done properly, is swamped by what if you open this bottle and let the genie out, and then some of these people who are really activists and ideological on climate change issues, what if they start getting their way? Okay, let me see if you guys have any questions. Got just a few minutes left here. Okay. Matt Miller asks, do all proposals for a carbon tax involve setting the tax at the social cost of carbon? Has anyone proposed taxing it at maybe 50% of the social cost of carbon, since that might be more politically attainable and hurt the economy less? Yeah, Matt. I don't know of anyone that says we're going to tax it at X percentage of the social cost of carbon, because for one thing, that would sound funny. It would sound like they weren't doing their job. But a lot of the some of the proposals do just kind of pick a number that they think is erring on the low side, and they even just will justify it by saying, "Well, step in the right direction." And this is kind of just as a marker to get things going, and at least then maybe we can in consultation with other countries try to get them on board for a more coordinated policy and that kind of stuff. So. Yes, to answer your question, some of the proposals are lower than what a lot of people would say at the time was a social cost of carbon. Okay, Wesley says, if new evidence emerges revising or discrediting the theory government raised the cap, that's what's happening in many places now, right? Okay, so if I understand what you're asking, I think you're saying, suppose you had a cap and trade system in place, and then new information came to light, and then would the government relax the cap, in other words, issue more permits?